Alrighty, we are studying the book of Genesis. I'm on page 113. Thank you, Sam. Genesis 24, verse 1. We're talking about Eleazar and Isaac. Eleazar and Isaac, a study in contrast. Isaac, you know, is the son of Abraham. We know who he is. Fewer people know who Eleazar is. Eleazar of Damascus was a slave that Abraham adopted and became his chief steward. Eleazar was nearly an adult when he was discovered by Abraham and found him. And he was the number one steward over Abraham and all that he had. He was the guy that Abraham depended upon to run things, and he was very good at it. Now Abraham, verse 1:24, was old, advanced in age. And the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, "Please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven, God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. But you shall go to my country, to my relatives, and take a wife for my son Isaac." The servant said to him, "Suppose the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came?" And then Abraham said to him, "Beware lest you take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, who spoke to me, who swore to me, saying, 'To your descendants I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife from my son there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you shall be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there." So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him according to this matter. Now, Abraham is moving to continue his line. It's been a long journey just to get this son. He was 99 years old when this son was born. Abraham's going to live to about 175, just to give you some perspective. And the son is now 20, 25 years, something like that. And Abraham is sending his servant back to Ur of the Chaldees, from which his family came, in order to find a wife for his son Isaac. In Canaan, nobody knows the God of Noah. In Ur of the Chaldees, many still do, and many of his family still do. And so he wants him to take a bride from there. Why was Isaac unable to get his own wife? 25 years old, maybe older, maybe 30, I have to do the math, but somewhere in there. And yet he's unable to go get his own wife. Abraham thinks he's unable. Isaac doesn't seem to be getting off his duff or wanting to. He was a rich mama's boy, doted on and pampered from his birth. When we see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we see three different men coming from three different places. And the thing about Isaac is he is easygoing and nice and relatively sinless. We don't get much about Isaac in the way of sin or bad behavior. He shows little or no initiative throughout his entire life. He was raised as a rich man's son, and given everything by his father, and totally doted on by his mother. He is feminized. Now, you know, as we study Genesis, one of the things that God is showing us about all these people is they're human. We see their flaws, as well as all the various things that God did among them, the miraculous things, very courageous things they did. Because God wants us to realize that these people are made of no different clay than we are, that if he can use them, he can use us. We have a tendency to look at Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and others, Moses, Noah, etc., as if they're like super beings. Somehow or another, they're extraordinary people. And they were able to accomplish things because they're made of different clay, but it's not true. And Genesis goes to the great depths to show us the flaws in all these people. In fact, much of the story of Genesis is about their breakdowns, as well as how God used them. We see characters that are great and mighty in terms of the pantheon of the Old Testament saints. they're out and out crooks in some ways. Jacob, for instance, means supplanter. Slick, he would have been called if his name had a nickname, Slick. He was crafty. And it wasn't until he was 40 that he actually repented and came to know the Lord. After much story about him, we read all that. Even Abraham, who is the father of our faith, demonstrates his lack of faith noticeably on three or four occasions, and is chastised by pagans for his bad behavior. In that regard, God stands up for Abraham, but also deals with him for his bad behavior. So none of these people are better than we are. God just used them, and they walk with God. And we are capable of doing anything and everything that any of them did. Joseph, Moses, Noah, Sarah, Ruth, Esther, all these people. And Genesis and the other stories, the historical books of the Bible, make it a point to show us that. And in our religious way, we have a tendency to portray these people on the flannel graph as if they were, you know, born righteous and got better. And it isn't true. It's meant to encourage us. Isaac lacked initiative because he never had to do anything for himself. He was easygoing, nice, and relative sense. He was dominated by his women from his youth. Abraham is getting Isaac a wife because Isaac has lost his mama. Verse 67 tells us that the reason why Abraham is choosing this point to get him a wife is because his mama's died. And Isaac is incapable of functioning without somebody being his mama. And so Abraham has got to go out and find him a wife. One of the reasons he wants the wife picked from his family group is because he knows he's going to be led by his wife. And if he chooses one of these Canaanite women, he'll be lost. And so he sends him back for somebody who comes out of the same belief system and value system. And who he gets is perfect, in the sense that she can manage him quite well. We'll get into all that as we go along.
Let me try to explain, because I missed it the very first time. Please place your hand under my
Bible. I'm coming there. Okay. And I knew you'd run to that right away. I'm coming there. I've written a section just for you. No, it's a very good question. I'll get there. So, Abraham's getting Isaac a wife because Isaac lost his mama. Is this a good thing or a bad thing, and why? What are we seeing here? I recommend that we read Wild at Heart by John Eldridge, especially if we're raising sons. The church has become quite feminized in the way it has raised its boys for some many years now. And John Eldridge speaks to this when he's talking about how we're supposed to raise our sons from a biblical point of view. Wild at Heart, he's basically saying, boys are by definition born troublesome. And it's in the process of learning to manage all of that, develop all of that, all this sort of thing, that they become men. Arlington Cemetery is neat and peaceful. It's also full of dead men. It's easier to tame a wild horse than to resurrect a dead one. And we are meant, we're not meant to be so socialized that we're feminized, that we as men do not do what it is God wants us to do. And yet too often that's the case. I remember when I went to seminary, people were suggesting I shouldn't do that. I was 50 years old and I'd been in business, and they said, if you become a preacher, no one will pay attention to you anymore, because there's men, women, and preachers. It's like a third gender, you know. They're she's, hims, and shims, the ones in the middle. And they said, you'll lose credibility with real people if you go become a minister. That tells you what people think of ministers and whatever. They're sort of like half women, half men, good for some things, not for others. It is in the struggles of life that we grow and mature. It is in the struggles of life that we encounter God. One of the things we see constantly in our characters is in their flaws they encounter God. We got Jacob wrestling with God and learning and growing from it. We have these various people, Judah, wrestling with God, and in the process becoming the man of God that allowed him eventually to become the head of the tribes. But it's his mistakes and his leaving home and his events with Tamar, the daughter-in-law whom he impregnated, thinking she was a prostitute. All of these things caused him to be dealt with by God, and in that process he grew up. The encounter between us and God is what makes us grow. Now, it would be wonderful if we could just always do the right thing, interface with God, and that's cool. It's just not real. And very often, some of the hardest things in my life have been the things that have done the most to cause me to come closer to God and to grow in the way that I should. One of the problems we have in the modern church is we like to pretend that we're sinless. You know, it's kind of like we walk around and go, I'm okay, you're okay, I mean, I'm sure, whatever. And, you know, when we talk about bad people, it's those people out there. Well, the truth of the matter is that as long as we pretend that we are not flawed, then we can hide from the process that would make us not only become unflawed, but grow up. So, you might want to read John Eldridge on that. All real accomplishments involve wrestling and risk. Isaac, as we shall see, never developed an ounce of spiritual discernment. We're going to get to that story later. Because he looked to his mama versus to his God. Mamas, don't let your baby boys grow up to be wussies. I think Willie Nelson had something about that. Abraham did not want his son to marry a Canaanite. He knew this son would be led astray by marrying a pagan. It is fundamental that husbands and wives should be equally yoked in all matters related to God. Marriage is tough enough without disparate theologies and philosophies. This is true even if both people are Christians. We need to share the same commitment and understanding to and understanding about the Lord. Now, Sam, put your hand under my thigh and swear to me. It's a guy thing.
What is that?
I don't know. I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
It's a guy thing. It's also a cultural thing. In a culture where offspring are highly prized, in the ancient world, the ability to bear children was the demarcation of a successful woman, and the ability to generate children was the demarcation of a successful man. You needed to continue your line. You needed offspring. You needed offspring to help with the process of raising your crops or your sheep or whatever. And people were judged as blessed directly proportional to the number of the children they had. We tend to think a little bit differently than that today. But in those days, you have as many as you can. You're feeding them off the land. It's not like food's going to be a problem. You need the laborers. You got a high death rate. You need people to help defend yourself. So have a lot of kids. And so since offspring are highly, highly prized, that when they would swear, one of the highest oaths they can make was to put your hand under my thigh. It's a euphemism, which means swear on my genitals. And what it means is that should you break this, me and everyone who follows after me will kill you. I mean, this is the big swear. Now, obviously, their culture and ours, obviously their culture is very different than ours. But if you read anything, you understand that these are shepherds, whatever. They're not real religious in the sense that we are. They're not puritanical, whatever. They're very natural. It means Eleazar is asked to swear on Abraham's genitals. Now, this is a serious oath tied to a blood feud if it's broken. This is all part of the culture. If it meant any offspring of mine, born or yet unborn, will avenge me against you and yours forever if you break this oath. Lex Talionis, the law of retaliation. This is long before Moses, the liberal, came along and said an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It's Lex Talionis is the ancient law of retaliation, which promulgated that if you injure me, I will retaliate by killing your wives, children, relatives, dogs, and cats. And
so Moses actually watered down the law.
Moses was a liberal. But the law of Moses is different, but the natural law was the Lex Talionis. That's why we see in the Middle East today,
right,
they're always wanting to jump up and kill everybody.
Right.
Because they're still operating under the pre-Judeo-Christian thinking. That's why you see them behave so much the way they do. They're still in the culture of the ancient Bible. And, you know, should you offend one of those people in that culture, they will endeavor to slaughter you and everybody around you, as we can see. We can see it. When Moses came along, God was using him to bring some fairness and equity into the process. So Moses said, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. So if someone offends you, you may not take revenge upon them beyond what the offense was. I think when we talk about justice, we want it to be measured and appropriate. So if somebody knocks over a liquor store, you know, you don't hang them for that. You know, on the other hand, you know, we have people who kill each other and they get off in 6 years, and we got other people, you know, who are selling pot and they're in jail for 30 years. So one of the reasons that the death penalty in this country has little or no resemblance to the death penalty of the Bible. The death penalty in the Bible was immediate. It was measured. It was easily just, but not today. So Eliezer will not swear until Abraham adds the proviso that if the young woman will not come with him, he will be released from his oath. This is a serious oath. He will not take it unless Abraham adds this contract. He is a faithful and godly steward who could have been Isaac's, could have taken Isaac's place. He could have been the heir. Could have been the heir. Genesis 15:2. Back on page. You sure you want to go here? Okay. No,
I mean, if Carol and I had a pact, or no.
All right. Let me get that out of the way.
It's on page 75.
Yeah. On page 75, in the very top, Genesis 15:1, it says, after all these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. God has promised Abram that he is going to provide him with an heir. In fact, he's going to change his name from Abram, great father, to Abraham, father of many. 15:2. And Abram said, O Lord, what wilt thou give me, since I am childless and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? How can you bless me? But I mean, there's nothing you can give me. I have everything I need but a child. And how can you possibly bless me? Because I'm childless. And the person who's going to inherit all that I have is my steward, Eleazar of Damascus. And his son, one born in my house, will take over from there. That's my condition that I'm in. So as wealthy and as well off as I am, I'm poverty stricken because I have no heir. And all that I have and all that I've accumulated, all you've given me, will be handed over to Eleazar of Damascus. So Eleazar of Damascus is a faithful and godly steward. He's one of those people in the Bible that you don't hear much about, but he's an extraordinary example, especially if you're a person who works in the marketplace, you're a manager of things. He's always working on behalf of his master to do what's right for him. He's wise. He's very good with his stewardship. He stands to gain if he misuses it, but he doesn't. You know, all he's got to do is lose the bride, and eventually Abraham will die. And well, of course, Isaac's born now, but in the past, that's what would have happened. So then the servant, that's Eleazar, took 10 camels from the camels of his master, and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. And he rose and he went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. So he loads these camels down with all manner of goodies and presents and the wealth of the land or whatever, because he's in the market for a bride. And so he goes to Mesopotamia, to Haran, the city of Abram's father, who's dead by now, to Abram's brother Nahor, to find a bride for Abram's son from among his kin. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time, and the time when the women came out to draw water. So he's looking for a bride, and he's asking God to show him, who should I check into? Who should I seek? You know, show me who is supposed to be Isaac's bride. He said, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers back, drink and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac. And by this I know that thou hast shown mercy or loving kindness to my master. So he's putting out a fleece to God. This is a process that saints used to call putting out a fleece. He's setting a fleece. I'm going to say this, and if the girl answers back exactly this way, then I'll know that's the girl. Now, if I say this, and the girl says, get your own water, stupid, or something like that, or sure, I'll get you a drink, but she didn't mention the camels, she didn't go that extra mile to say, I'll feed your camels also, then that's not the girl. This process, we go all the way back in the Bible, actually, all the way forward in the Bible, is where we see it gets its name. And that's when Gideon is approached many, many years later about rising up and becoming the judge over Israel to save them from their enemies, the Philistines or Hittites, whoever it was, Malachites, whoever was on them at that particular point in time. And Gideon was a meek man, a weak man. And he's tempting or testing the Lord to see if this word is really from God. And so he lays a lambskin out, a fleece, and he says, Lord, in the morning when I wake up, let the fleece be soaking with water and the ground around it totally dry. And so the next day he gets up and the fleece is full of water and the ground's dry. And God says, well, all right, what about that? He said, well, tomorrow let the ground be wet and the fleece be dry. So whatever. And the saints named that, the old people, they named that fleecing the Lord, or trying to put a fleece before the Lord. It means giving God a test by which you will know what it is supposed to do. And that's what Eleazar of Damascus is doing all these way back here. He's speaking to the God of Abraham, not his God, the God of Abraham, the God of my master. He says, Lord, God of my master, let this, when I approach these girls, the one that makes the right response, let her be the right girl. So came about before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. The girl was very beautiful, a virgin, no man had relations with her, which is by definition what a virgin is. She went down to the spring and filled her jar, and she came up. Then the servant ran to meet her, Eleazar, and said, please let me drink some water from your jar. And she said, well, drink, my lord, small L, it's an honorific, drink, my lord. And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving a drink, she said, I will draw also water for your camels until they have finished drinking. So she's loaded her jar, she's got it up on her shoulder, it's heavy, you know, whatever. And he runs up to her and says, can I have a drink out of your jar? Well, she could say, the well's right there. But she does, and she's hospitable, she takes it down, she pours him off a drink, and she said, let me get some for your camels also. So a little bit about the character of this particular person. She's got a servant's heart, and she's honorable, and whatever. And so now he knows that he's found this person. And she was very beautiful, and she was virgin, she was marriageable. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough. She just finished filling it up, was heading back with it. Now she's got to go refill it to take it back home again, because she pours it out into the trough for the camels. Ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all the camels. So multiple times she pours it out. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. It came about when the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half a shekel and two bracelets for her wrist weighing 10 shekels in gold. And he said, whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house? This is all part of the culture. And she said, I am the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. And now he realizes that he's actually found Nahor's brother's granddaughter, I guess. And she said to him, we have plenty of both straw and feed and room to lodge in. Hospitality in the ancient world was an art that was considered very important. And she knows that hospitality is available to all who come in her house. She can speak, yes, we have a room and place for your camels, etc. And the man bowed low and he worshiped the Lord. And he said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers. So he's come all this way, months, and he's found at this well, he's found somebody who's the granddaughter of his master's brother. Anyway, the girl ran and I think I've covered all that other stuff. Well, let me look at some of this here. Abraham knows Abraham. Eliezer knows Abraham's God and trusts him to bring about success to the task. He's a worthy man and a role model of good stewardship. Isaac should have been able to handle this. Jacob, later, Isaac's son, never has any problem finding his own wife at about the same age. So, and nor is anybody else in all this group. Isaac should be able to handle this, but he was not prepared for it. His loving, doting parents did him a great disservice in his upbringing. The problem with discipleship is always in release. Discipleship is a process that we all should have grown up in with our fathers, and we should be a part of. But the problem is in release. The disciple always wants to be released sooner, and the master always thinks the disciple's not ready yet. If you all remember the story of Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker, the struggle between them creates Darth Vader. Because one wants to be released sooner than the other one thinks they should. Isaac is never allowed to unlatch from his mother or to stand as a mature man at the side of his father. So then the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things. Now Rebekah has a brother whose name was Laban. We're going to run into Laban a lot here in the next few chapters. Laban ran outside to the man at the spring, and it came about that when he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrist, when he heard the words of Rebekah, his sister saying, this is what the man said to me. He went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. And he said, come in and be blessed to the Lord. Why do you stand outside since I have prepared the house and a place for the camels? So the man entered the house, and Laban unloaded the camels, which gives him an opportunity to do an inventory, by the way, on what's on them. We'll see as we go along. He gave straw and feed to the camels and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. But when food was set before him to eat, he said, I will not eat until I have told my business. This is Eliezer. I will not eat. I won't sit down and take your meal until I've conducted my business. It's business before pleasure. He's all business about taking care of what he's been sent to. What he doesn't want to have happen is to sit down and have a nice meal and a bunch of wine, get all loaded, and that guy he's negotiating with is learning how to take his measure and take advantage of it. We see, for instance, when Jacob shows up here 20 years later, he wines and dines before he conducts business, and he wakes up with the wrong wife. Laban is slick. He is one slick dude, and he's not a man of honor. But Eleazar, who is wise and mature and a man among men, says, no, I'm going to do business before I will sit down and eat with you. And he, that's Laban, said, speak on. So he said, I am Abraham's servant. The Lord has greatly blessed my master so that he has become rich, and he has given him flocks, herds and silver and gold and servants and maids and camels and donkeys, as evidenced by all that I've brought here. Abraham is a legend to these people. Abraham was the firstborn son of his father, Terah, and his brother Haran died, and so Abraham took on Haran's child, Lot, and raised him, and his brother Nahor, and Abraham was going to be the kinsman redeemer when his father died. He's going to be in charge of this wealthy tribe and all these people. And he sat and listened to the teachings of Noah, his tutor, at the city gates with all the other children, and he hears the word of the Lord from Noah's mouth, and he believes. And he begins to seek God, and God begins to speak to him in a voice. And in a fairly short period of time, Abraham hears the voice of the Lord say, come out of all of this, follow me into the wild, wild world. Trust me to protect you and bring you to a place of great blessing, and I will be your God, and you will be my guide. And Abram throws over all the wealth, power, and prestige, bird in hand, for a voice of someone he's never seen, who's speaking to him, and he believes the voice, because he believed Noah who heard the voice. And so he follows the voice away from protection, away from wealth, away from all of this, in order to follow the voice and walk with God through all these many, many trials. He's a legend to the people. And the servant has now said, God has blessed my master Abraham. And he has this and this and this and this and this and this. And this is some gifting from that you can see. I am Abraham's servant. And the Lord has greatly blessed. Oh, you did this, okay? Now Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master in her old age, and he has given him, my master's son, Abraham, all that he has. He's going to be rich. My master made me swear, saying, you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I live, but you shall go to my father's house and to my relatives and take a wife for my son. Chief steward of all that Abraham has, he would have been responsible for all the major duties, and finding, you know, taking a wife, especially after Abraham's gone, he would have organized all of that. Don't take them from the land. Go back to my father's house. And I said to my master, suppose the woman does not follow me. And he said to me, the Lord, before whom I walked, will send his angel with you to make your journey successful. And you will take a wife for my son from my relatives and from my father's house. And then you will be free from my oath when you come to my relatives. And if they do not give her to you, you will be free from my oath. So Abraham said, my God will go before you. He will make you your way. It'll work out. Trust me, I know. God's going to work this out. And if they won't come, then you're free. So I came today to the spring, and I said to the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, if now that will make my journey on which I go successful, behold, I'm standing by the spring, and may it be that the maiden who comes and draws and says to whom I say, please let me drink a little water from your jar. And she will say to me, you drink, and I will draw for your camels also. Let her be the woman whom the Lord has appointed for my master's son. Before I had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder and went down the spring and drew. And I said to her, please let me drink. And she quickly lowered her jar from her shoulder and said, drink, and I will manage water your camels also. So I drank, and she watered the camels also. Then I asked her, whose daughter are you? And she said, I am the daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bore to him. I put the ring on her nose and the bracelet on her wrist, and I bowed low and I worshiped the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has guided me in the way, take me daughter of my master's kindred for his own son. Now if you are going to deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me. If not, let me go, that I may turn to the right or the left. We'll figure out something else to do. Did you notice the nose ring? You know, when we look at our people walking around with a nose ring, you go to the movie theater or the whatever, you go, look at that nose ring. Well, it's biblical, folks, you know. You should all get one. Anyway.
And so what does a nose ring actually mean?
It was a common form of jewelry decoration, you know. So he gives her a ring and she slips it in her nose. There's a hole right there for it. Puts things on her wrist. Yeah, well, if he's leading her by the nose ring, she's leading him by something else. Which one do you think is going to win that battle? Yeah. All right. Laban, as the kinsman redeemer, has a major responsibility to care for his women. That's one of the things the kinsman redeemer's got to do is to manage all of his household, provide for them and care for them. And in particular, one of the things that's important is his women. He's got to make sure his women get married off right. First of all, he's got to make sure that they wind up with a suitable match. And then he's got to make sure that he winds up prospering from the match that he makes, because women are basically used to obtain either privilege or title for the family in exchange. They're a bargaining chip. And so he's got to make sure they're well married and whatever. If you've ever watched Downton Abbey or something, you see the whole process, the whole issue of who's Mary going to marry, and that she got to save the empire, she got to save the manor and all the holdings and whatever through marriage. In fact, we see Lord Grantham was penniless. He had an estate, he was penniless, and he has to marry this rich widow from New York, Cora, in order to save the land and save it all. And at that time in England, late 1800s, early 1900s, it was very common because it was harder and harder to keep these castles afloat financially. And not just that, but all that went with them. And a lot of these young men who had titles were running off to America to find rich widows or rich single women. And they got to be the lady this, and he got their money. If you follow the story, there's a whole bunch about that. He manages to lose most of it, the bad investment, and all this kind of stuff. So Mary has got to marry in order to save the day. And she doesn't get to marry who she wants to. She's pressured into marrying someone that's going to save the ranch. So anyway, that's what's going on here. So he's got to be taking care of his women. And in Genesis 12, we talked a lot about kinsman redeemer, so I won't go there. Eleazar's visit is seen as an absolute windfall, especially since Eleazar has a rich and related master. So him showing up with all this wealth, it's a major windfall for Laban. This is cool. Especially since Eleazar has a rich and related master. Uncle Abraham is probably a family legend. This offers a unique ideal spot for Rebekah. Laban is all hospitality and proper behavior here. Later events tell us he's also cunning and deceitful. And remember, he's helped unload these camels, so he knows what this deal's worth. He's going to try to figure out how much he can get out of it. Especially, we want to get him fed and drunk. Well, we'll see what we can negotiate. Yeah.
You've said that they were so much into hospitality. Would it have been that unusual for somebody like Rebecca to offer to feed the camels water?
Oh, to give the camels water? Probably. But to invite them to her house? Young girls did not usually have a lot of conversation with strange men. And so it would be, he might have said something to her and she might have said this and moved on. But instead she was actually gregarious with him, but it was mean. First of all, it indicates she's a confident person. She's, she comes from wealth, so she, she's not like all shy and whatever. But she also is confident enough to speak for her household. We're glad to give you hospitality. So she's an aristocrat, so to speak, in this culture, a feudal culture, whatever. And, pardon?
She had a lot that Isaac lacked.
Well, yeah, she did. And don't go there, Sam. At any rate, he's all business. He's very wise. He knows better than to eat and drink with Laban until he has discharged his duty. He's older, wiser, and more experienced than Jacob will be 20 years later when we get to that part of the story. Jacob's going to show up in the same place, make the wrong decisions, and wind up being a slave for years and years and years. Married to the wrong woman, cheated out of everything. Jacob, who was slick, got out-slicked by Uncle Laban until God finally intervened. We'll get to there later. Sowing and reaping. Proverbs 23:1 says, when you sit down to dine with a ruler, it means a person of power, authority, nobility, someone wealthy, rich, somebody older, somebody wiser and more powerful than you. Consider carefully what is before you and put a knife to your throat. If you are a man of great appetite, do not desire his delicacies, for it is a deceptive food. What he's saying is, if you are called into the opportunity to fellowship with someone who's great and famous and big and whatever, may overrank you or whatever, and they're sort of drawing you in, put your knife to your throat, shut your mouth. Put your knife to your throat rather than to be consumed in his delicacies, by his delicacies. Don't be in such a hurry to suck it all up. Kings, nobles, people like that, they'll just sit and listen while you rattle on. Use some wisdom, Proverbs says. And Solomon would know. Let's see, there was some story I was talking about the other day where some king was asking somebody something and they were just rattling on one. I forget what it was now. Genesis 24, then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, "The matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go. Let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken." So Laban and Bethuel, they can easily see this is going to be a good deal. They said, "This is the Lord's doing. So take the girl and go. Take the girl and go." They didn't ask her. They just said, "Take her and go. This is a good deal. What we pulled off that camel's enough, and you know we've got to hook into this rich man now, and so this is good."
Yeah, Bethel's her father.
Bethel's her grandfather. Laban.
Grandfather.
Yeah. So we have generations: Nahor and Bethel, Laban, whatever. Probably Bethel's old, and Laban's sort of de facto the leader and whatever. But Bethel's going to be consulted. At any rate, they said, "Take her and go." It came about when Abram's servant heard their words, that he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord, and the servant brought out articles of silver and articles of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. Then he and the men who were with him ate and drank and spent the night. When they rose in the morning, he said, "Send me away to my master. Release me to go home." Now, the deal is he's in a foreign land. He is in a feudal world. It's what we think of as an Arab world. He is in the mercy of these people who are more powerful than he is. He's come among them, and he's asking permission to leave. He can't just take off and go, especially with the girl. He might be able to leave himself, but he's saying, "Send me away, you know, let me go." But her brother and her mother said, "Let the girl stay with us a few days, say 10, and afterwards she may go." So, you know, let her stay for a while. We don't want to lose her like this, but that's not the issue. The issue is in 10 days they can figure out all kinds of ways to get their hooks into what's going on with him. And they're acting like somehow or another they're really going to miss this girl if she goes. We're going to see her in a minute that she leaves in a New York minute. Like that. She's ready. She's out of here. Because once she's been bargained away, her best bet is where she's going, not where she's at. She doesn't seem to be real sentimental about hanging out there with Mama and her brother. And he said to them, "Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master." Eliezer figures the sooner I get out of here, the safer it's going to be for everybody. The longer I have to stay, the more treacherous it is. And they said, "We will call the girl and consult her wishes." Then they called Rebekah and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "You bet. I will go now." Thus they sent away their sister Rebekah and her nurse with Abram's servant and his men, her servant and men. They blessed Rebekah and they said to her, "May you, our sister, become thousands of ten thousands. May your descendants possess the gates of those who hate them." So Laban quickly agrees to the match, declares it's from the Lord. We know that from later texts that Laban is more interested in what is in the sacks on Eleazar's camel than he is in Rebekah. He acquiesces quickly, quicker than you can say "whiffum." You know, "whiffum" is what's in it for me. "You bet." Laban tries to get Eleazar to hang around a little while. Eleazar understands the ploy and presses for immediate departure. Remember the last couple of weeks we've been talking about the deals between these guys, Arabs, like over the Machpelah cave and King David buying the floor, all the negotiation, the Arab negotiation processes. This is all part of that culture. Eleazar understands the ploy and he presses for an immediate departure. Laban is like the innkeeper Thénardier in Les Miserables, who made his fortune picking through the dead at Waterloo and spends the rest of his life fleecing anyone he can. How many of you all seen Les Miserables? Gosh, you all are deprived.
Is there a coloring book out yet?
Yeah, that's right. If you haven't seen Les Miserables, especially if you've seen the 25th anniversary version done by the West Side of London's best.
That's very good.
It's excellent. Thénardier was this guy. The book starts off with the battlefield between Napoleon and whoever it is he's fighting. And it's gone very badly, and Thénardier is a young soldier who's going through the crowd, through the dead, picking their pockets. And he stumbles across a guy who's not quite yet dead yet, you know, like Monty Python. He's not quite dead yet. And he winds up sort of accidentally saving the guy's life, and which creates a ramification in the story later. Well, the next time we see Thénardier, he is taking his ill-gotten gains, and he's set himself up an inn that he uses to fleece everybody who comes through. It's a very comical process. And then we wind up with Thénardier again later down the line at the end of the movie, stealing from people and all this kind of stuff. And that's Laban. He's like Thénardier. Eleazar is outnumbered. He's in a dangerous place, and he knows it. Even still, Eleazar is a man of strength and wisdom, and Yahweh is with him. And Abraham is a legend with whom one does not trifle. So Laban drops the mask and asks Rebecca flatly if she wants to go. How much trouble do you think Eleazar would have had hanging on to his silver if she had said no? Eleazar could have disappeared and Laban would have been richer. It would have been not unheard of. He's out there, he's alone, he's got a bunch of wealth with him. There's no record. And he knows it. Rebecca agrees to go in record time. Living in Laban's household was probably not a wonderful thing for a girl. And we can see his motives and his behaviors. But in fact, when later on, we see him even worse when we get there with Jacob. She could have been sold to anyone with a drachma at any time. Now this is, I mean, this is the reality. Someone could come along and offer Laban whatever it is they offered, and she was gone. She was sold. Here's a guy. He's got plenty of wealth. He's got manners. He's obviously a wise man. This is a relative. She stands a really good chance of prospering in this deal. But she could have just as easily been the 14th wife of some sheikh. So she says, yep, let's go. Let's get out of here. Yahweh was watching over the event. Laban prays over her, the father of the bride prayer, which we saw up in verse 60. We'll have to stop there, I guess. Comments? Okay, y'all, somebody pray us out.